Kissinger knows that Le Docteau has fought the French and has been tortured at the prison of Poulot Condor, and that he has a top-level position in the Vietnamese Communist Party leadership. But he does not know that he has in front of him a member of the resistance, one of the leaders of the Liberation Army, who has just left the South Vietnam combat zone. As for Le Docteau, he is aware of Kissinger's past, his escape from Nazi Germany in the 1930s, his closeness to Nixon, his profile as an intellectual, a lecturer at Harvard, and a public figure accustomed to the bright lights of high society. But a major event delays the first meeting between Kissinger and Le Docteau. On September 2, 1969, in Hanoi, Ho Chi Minh passes away. At his bedside are Le Docteau and the other leaders of the country. In the middle of the war, a national state funeral is organized. Washington wonders whether the death of the emblematic leader might not influence the morale of troops. During the period of mourning, an entire people echo what Ho Chi Minh had proclaimed: Americans will never, never gain victory over us. On February 21, 1970, the first secret session between Le Docteau and Henry Kissinger takes place. The Vietnamese delegation is hosting, in a house it has hired, far from Avenue Kléber in Paris, at 11 Rue d'Arte in Choisy-le-Roi. The session is scheduled to start at 9:30 a.m. Precautionary and meticulous, Le Docteau arrives early. Self-confident, Henry Kissinger and his four colleagues arrive on time.
It was the first time that Le Docteau and Kissinger met. They shook hands, and then exchanged a few words of courtesy, according to protocol.
10 people sit around a large rectangular table, including the interpreters. The two delegations find themselves face to face. The shutters are closed. There is a subdued atmosphere, far removed from the chaos of war. The two men weigh each other up.
During the secret meetings, we discussed issues. The term Henry Kissinger used was substantial issues.
The first meeting lasts nearly 6 hours. It is 9:40 a.m. as the countdown of the secret negotiation begins. Le Docteau says he does not trust American loyalty. You speak of peace, but you are waging war. We are wary because we have often been deceived. In 1945, we signed an agreement with the French, but they sent us troops. 9 years later, we reached an agreement in Geneva, which was torn up almost as soon as it was signed. So I am now wondering if your goodwill is sincere. I suggest you speak to us frankly. During this decade of war, you have spent a lot of money, gaining nothing in exchange. I do not understand. What interest do you have in continuing this war? When summing up to Nixon, Kissinger allowed himself a hint of optimism. On the major points, Mr. President, we totally disagree. But this first meeting remains positive. After lunch, taken separately, discussions resume. Le Docteau brings up several points at length.
The withdrawal of the American troops from South Vietnam was followed by the issue of the Saigon administration. Then the question of North Vietnamese troops stationed in South Vietnam came up, and then the issue of the demilitarized zone.
Kissinger fixes a priority for their following encounter. Our first objective is to reach a reciprocal agreement. We will withdraw our soldiers from South Vietnam, and you repatriate yours to North Vietnam, along with your troops currently present in Cambodia and Laos. The two men meet again in March and April 1970. For Le Docteau, sending American troops into Vietnam is clearly illegal. Kissinger replies that the presence of the North Vietnamese army in the South is also illegal, and he lays down a condition. I'll withdraw my troops only if you withdraw yours, Mr. Special Advisor. Le Docteau does not give way. He repeatedly states, Mr. Security Advisor, we are on home ground. This is an issue between the Vietnamese. The aggressor is you. Barely a month later, a new American attack puts an end to the talks between the two men. On On April 29, 1970, a massive B-52 bombing campaign is carried out on East Cambodia, along the border with Vietnam. A similar campaign is carried out a few months later in Laos. The objective is to destroy the headquarters of the North Vietnamese High Command and that of the NLF, and to cut off the Ho Chi Minh Trail. A Ho Chi Minh Trail that has by now become a network of several thousand kilometers, a lifeline between the North and the South, along which transit provisions, military equipment, and troops, a network of tracks that the Americans have been bombing for 10 years in vain. The intervention in Cambodia causes major protest demonstrations, which are violently repressed by the National Guard. On Kent State campus, four students are killed.
I think except for the peace movement, there would have been no peace talks in Paris. The anti-war movement reached a new high in 1968 with the March on the Pentagon, which was massive, tens of thousands, over 50,000 probably people moving toward the Pentagon, where the offices of all the military services. It had a huge impact on the country because they could see that that there was real power, that there were masses behind, tens of thousands that were out there protesting. The people wanted peace. They wanted an end to the killing in Vietnam.
Aware of the power of the peace movement, Nixon starts his mandate in 1969 with a program for U.S. Army withdrawal.
I have decided to reduce the authorized troop ceiling in Vietnam to 484,000 by December 15.
Blocking the route to communism is no longer the priority of the moment, given that the U.S. has lost a large part of its credit and prestige in the world. Richard Nixon wants to pull out of Vietnam, but has to do so with honor and without humiliation in order to restore U.S. splendor. An initial withdrawal of 50,000 men out of a total of 536,000, a pace at which Vietnam is not about to find peace.
Okay, too big. Okay, try another one.
South Vietnamese soldiers have to take over from the Americans. The objective is to recruit, equip, and train 400,000 men over 3 years, creating the greatest military force in Southeast Asia entirely from scratch. Over a year goes by before Henry Kissinger and Lê Duc Tho meet again, in July 1971. Is peace, so long awaited, getting nearer? Or are they buying time? Their strategy has not changed. Hanoi demands total withdrawal of U.S. troops, and Washington stalls by gradually withdrawing its soldiers while the ranks of the Saigon Army are being reinforced. Time for Hanoi and the NLF to catch their breath after months of combat? Probably.
The talks in Paris between Kissinger and Tho continued because the North Vietnamese were used to what we call in Vietnamese talks and military offensive at the same time.
We argued over territory, you could say. They were also very difficult years for us at the end of 69, 70, even 71, because the U.S. weapons were deadly, too.
For 10 years, until 1971, tens of thousands of tons of highly toxic chemicals, including the dioxin containing Agent Orange, are poured onto South Vietnam. The code name is Ranch Hand. The aim is to destroy the vegetation in order to kill the enemy hiding in it. But the victims are also civilians, men, women, and children. Science at the service of the unspeakable. a methodical and systematic spreading technique. The longest chemical war the world has known. An ecocide. Still today, the dioxin causes death and disability. In Paris, negotiations collapse and the prospect of peace recedes. No meetings take place between autumn 1971 and the beginning of 1972. Nixon travels to Peking in the first visit by an American head of state under the Mao regime. He then travels to Moscow. East-West relations are warming up. It is a historical moment for world balance and peace. It is the opportunity for Nixon and Kissinger to ask the Chinese and Soviets to reduce the military aid they give to their North Vietnamese ally and to put pressure on them. Tell them to make concessions. They are not heard.
We received heavy weaponry from the Soviet Union, and then light weaponry, and especially logistical assistance from China. But we use the weaponry to carry out our own war. Not with the presence or the participation of foreign soldiers on our land. In Vietnam, it was a war of liberation and not an international or a world war.
Over the space of 2 years, Lê Duc Tô and Henry Kissinger meet 10 times, always in secret. Can these face-to-face meetings really put an end to the conflict? Confronting their arguments obliges the men to draw up a peace plan. They have learned to weigh each other up, to pick up on their opponent's strengths and weaknesses, to grasp the way each of them work, and to test their intelligence.
I think Kissinger is a highly intelligent man. He has a great deal of humor and a lot of experience in negotiating. But he's a man of maneuvers, and he's imperturbable.
I have developed great respect for Lê Duc Tô. He was the representative of a relatively small country, negotiating with a superpower. His strategy was to break our spirit and give us no hope of a settlement except to yield to their terms. He did it with great discipline, great dignity, great politeness, and great mastery of the subject. So it was our bad luck that he was our adversary. He appeared as the representative of a communist power devoted to Marxist ideology, and he had the American peace movement on his side, so he thought he had time. We had to try to endure, out-endure him.
Lê Duc Tô fought too, in a very courageous but also intelligent way. That's why we say that Mr. Kissinger, who is highly confident and perhaps just a little vain, he still had to. And I'm not sure if I'm using the right term here, but he had to bend down in front of Lê Duc Tô.
the spiritual message of Islam.
His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. If we all open our eyes to see, he is all that we need right now. And we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. لا حول ولا قوة إلا بالله العلي العظيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا ونبينا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد وعلى آله الطيبين الطاهرين لا سيما بقية الله في الأرضين أجل الله تعالى فرجه الشريف وجعلنا من أعوانه وأنصاره. Last night we spoke about the way that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has provided humanity with guidance for their personal progress and also for establishing a community, a universal community based on justice as a major value and other values that inshallah we will talk about it. When it comes to personal progress, all the prophets helped humanity in order to combat their ego, in order to combat temptations coming from their nafs ammara, their commanding soul, from Satan. They try to take them from darkness to light. But when it comes to establishing a just society, it was the job of the messengers, of the Rusul, who were given the book and Mizan, the scale or the balance, so that they would lead and guide humanity towards establishment of this social justice. لقد أرسلنا رسلنا بالبينات وأنزلنا معهم الكتاب والميزان ليقوم الناس بالقسط.
One of the beautiful verses of the Quran about this ummah which is going to be established, this community which is going to be established, is this ayah, Surah Baqarah, verse 143. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم.
وكذلك جعلناكم أمة وسطا لتكونوا شهداء على الناس. We have designed Islam in the way that you can be a balanced nation so that you would be witnesses for other nations. If Prophet is your leader, he is a witness for you, you are also to be leader and witness for other people. When it comes to relations, we have to be open. As Muslims, we must not separate ourselves and isolate ourselves from other people. Our houses, our offices, our centers, our schools should be open. But does it mean that we lose our own control? We lose our orientation? Do you want to invite them to a Muslim house and show them a Muslim family? Or you want to make your house a non-Muslim house and your family a non-Muslim family so that you welcome them? It's a big issue. Do you want to sacrifice some of your values in order to welcome people? Or you want to keep your values and say, come and see our values? If the community is diluting its values in order to welcome other people, when they come, then they say, you are like us. We don't see anything new in you.
Oh, what a wonderful world this would be if we all open our eyes to see. He is all that we need right now, and we can all come together somewhere, somehow. His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. Down this road that holds all the answers. Open your heart to something greater. His holy book speaks pure and true. Always tells us what we must do. His last prophet was sent as a guide, an example by which we abide. There is salvation for those who seek to find the one and only source of peace and understanding of why we are here, who created us, who we must fear. So what a wonderful world this would be if we all open our eyes to see. He is all that we need right now, and we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
You know, I remember a few years ago here, I think it was the year 2006 or 2007, there was a marriage, you know, interface, you know, program here. Some of you may remember that event. And there was a person from one community, not Muslim. And when he talked about marriage, he talked in the way that it was exactly like English marriage. And I was telling myself, everyone here knows that this is not what they do. How he is, you know, deceiving himself. When they ask you to come and represent the traditions of your own religion or your community, they expect you to say something different. But if you say everything as the English community is doing, then you are betraying your own tradition, and also you are wasting the time of people who are here. Because they know these things better. I don't want to mention which community, because that person doesn't necessarily represent the whole community, but that particular example was like this. So, it is very good to be open, and we have to be open. We have to welcome people. Whether they come to our house or to our mosque, we have to be hospitable. But at the same time, we have to understand that we are given some beautiful values, and those come to see these values. Not that we become like them and have nothing new to offer. So these are some aspects of this balance. And Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, if you have this balance, you become witness for other people. لَتَكُونُوا شُهَدَاءَ عَلَى النَّاسِ وَيَكُونَ الرَّسُولُ عَلَيْكُمْ شَهِيدًا. So how Rasulullah, this is a very beautiful point, how Rasulullah can provide all humanity with guidance? How can Rasulullah help humanity to establish those values? By having a community under him who represent his teachings. If Rasulullah was enough and he didn't need to have a community which corresponds to what he teaches and preaches, then he could have finished the job. But Rasulullah needs to tell to people, look at my community. If I tell you that you have to be just even to your enemies, look at my own community. If the community is like what Rasulullah preached, they all accept. And this is why I said last night that this is very vital for the success of Imam Zaman Ajjalallah Ta'ala Farajahu Sharif to have a community next to him that he can say, this is my theory and this is my sample. Do you want it? Here you are. But if you just give them theory, they say, we have, you know, heard many, many beautiful words. So many isms and schools of thought have come, and they spoke very nicely about justice, about this and that. We don't trust anyone. We need reality. We need haqiqah. Where is this haqiqah established in any part of the world so that we can trust you? So it's very important that we start with
achieving these qualities first among ourselves, and then inshallah Allah would honor us to pave the way for Imam Zaman inshallah to share it with the rest of humanity.
I'm looking back throughout the years to breathe is hard and my eyes are choked with tears. Your face and hair are full of light. Now it will soon be time to go. I feel you feeling calm now. Did the angel let you know?
Oh Allah, please send your salutations to Muhammad and all Muhammad. Oh Allah, please forgive us. Please forgive all our sins and mistakes and shortcomings. Please enable us to serve you with full honesty and truthfulness and sincerity. Please include us among the best followers of Muhammad and all Muhammad. Please protect and safeguard our community and our families and our youths from everything that you don't like. O Allah, please hasten the reappearance of Imam Zaman Ajjalallahu Ta'ala Farajahu Sharif. Please make our Imam Zaman happy with what we do and what we say. Please answer his du'as for his faraj. Please give shifa to all people who are ill. Please give shifa to people who are ill in their body and in their soul. O Allah, please send your rahmah, your forgiveness to all who have passed away, especially brothers and sisters who were attending these majalis in this community and other communities. Our parents, our foreparents, our teachers, our ulama, our maraji, those who have passed away, please let them be with Muhammad and Ali Muhammad right now. And please give long life and blessed life to the parents and to the teachers and maraji who are alive. O Allah, please make the last moment of our life the best moment of our life. Wa akhiru da'wana and alhamdulillahi rabbil alameen.
My ummah, he will say, Rasulullah on that day, even though we've strayed from him and his way. My brothers, my sisters in Islam, let's struggle, work and pray. If we are to bring back the glory of his way. Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again.
Ya Allah,
Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. Let us see daylight again, once again.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
like to discuss Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam in the light of the month that we are in, who gave everything for humanity.
For humanity.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program For Humanity here on IRIB English Radio. Thank you for joining us here today. I'm your host, Shiraz Agha. This program is a program that is concerned with examining various humanitarian dimensions of the movement of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. In this series of programs that we are going to present to you, we hope to examine a few topics related to the movement of Imam Hussein. Primarily, we hope to examine three basic dimensions of the Imam's movement. These aspects are concerned with various human rights. For example, the right to live or the right to life. The right to be free, the right of freedom, and third, the right of dignity. So we want to examine these basic rights and how they manifest themselves in the movement of Imam Hussein. In these first couple of episodes, we're going to examine the right to life. The right to life is a very basic right, one of the basic and primary rights of all human beings. It's something that has been mentioned in the Charter of Human Rights, you know, the famous Global Charter of Human Rights. Every right, every human being has the right to live. This is also something that religion affirms. It gives importance to the right to life. An example which can affirm this is the verse of the Holy Quran, which says that if somebody kills one human being, it's almost as if he has killed the entire humanity. And if somebody saves a human being, it's almost as if he has saved the entire humanity. Right, so the protection of life is something very important in religion. Obviously, if we can't physically live, then we won't have the ability to enjoy other aspects of life which are important. Right. So life is a very basic human right. Of course, we need to say this here. That there's various types of life, and in this way we can divide life into various categories, and each of the human beings have a right to each of these lives. For example, right, there's first of all, at a very basic level, there's the right to physical life, right? In other words, the right to live, not to be killed. Obviously, this also or another manifestation of this might be the right for medicine, right? In the case where a human being is sick, the right for the subsistence of his life. Every human being who's sick, he has a right to be cured and treated medically so that his life can continue. There's also spiritual life. When we say spiritual life, in life as defined by, you know, scholars, is knowledge and power, right? Knowledge and power. Beings that are alive are beings that have knowledge and power. Right? That's why we say that when we say that God is alive or he has life, right? It means that he has knowledge and power. Right? This knowledge and power, sometimes it's at a very basic level. Other times, as it grows more advanced, this life that is a necessary concomitant of it also increases, which is why we have spiritual life as well. This spiritual life can be the spiritual life of an individual, right? Like a single individual, who by becoming spiritual, he acquires a life, he becomes born again. And when we say that somebody is alive, right, meaning in the sense that he's come into this world, this entrance into this world, it could come in another form, an entrance into the spiritual world, or this could also be a birth or a life. This could be for an individual, and this could also be for a society as a whole. So therefore, when we say that a certain person or society as a whole has died, In this context, it means that they have lost their path to felicity. They've become misguided. Now, this life that God has given us, regardless of whether it's this physical life or the spiritual life, is a gift from God. As being a gift from God, it doesn't belong to us. You might even say that it's something that God has given us to use, and therefore it doesn't belong to us. Like anything, like even our existence as a whole doesn't belong to God, to us. And therefore, we have no right to interfere in it and to negate it from ourselves. Like this is why, one of the reasons why we were not allowed to commit suicide. Now, when we look at the movement of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, we see that one of the reasons why he stood up and he began his movement, and in this path he attained martyrdom, he gave his life for this purpose, and in this path was this the preservation of the right to live. When we examine the situation in the time of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, we see that this right to life all in all aspects was being negated from human beings. First of all, the Umayyads, which was the ruling party and the ruling faction at that time and in that era and in that place, right? They were killing people, murdering people in order to strengthen their hold on the reins of the government. This was on one hand. So they were negating the right to basic physical life from the people. At the same time, we see that they had they were negating the spiritual life from the people, in the sense that they were using their propaganda machine to create disinformation and misinform the people regarding many truths, and in this way, the right to spiritual life was being negated from them. They were also prevented from referring to the family of the Prophet, the Ahlul Bayt, alayhim as-salam, which is also, in fact, an instance of this negation of the right to live, right to spiritually live from these people. Imam Hussein, alayhi salam, he came to revive this people and to help them live again. It's a famous tradition has been related from Imam Hussein, that in which he says that, I have stood up in order to rectify the situation of the nation of my grandfather, the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. This rectification, in fact, is the reviving of this nation, granting them this right to live once again. Or, for example, in another tradition, Imam Hussein has said that I rose up and I stood up, or we rose and we stood up, so that we could place the flags of guidance for the people to guide them towards what is good for them and what is in their best interest spiritually as well as intellectually. It's also necessary here to remember that this revivification of religion in general is one of the responsibilities of the Imam alayhi salam, and it's for this reason that when the Imam is in this situation, he's his responsibility spiritually and religiously to stand up and help revive religion. It's probably also for this reason that Imam Hussein, some of his companions or some of the people around him, right, suggested to him, said to him that if you feel constrained and constricted here in this land, you can go and live in another land where there is no such constraints. But the Imam rejected this proposal and said, no, my responsibility, my religious responsibility demands that I stay here and I perform this duty and help revive this nation. Thank you for joining us here on For Humanity. We were looking at the right to live, the right to life, and how it's connected with the movement of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Hope you have instilled in our heart, in a world where hopes disappear.
Peace you have ingrained in our soul. In a time when peace becomes rare, every breath that you did take, every step that you would make, purpose and guidance it gave, mankind's heart it reawaked. Many people did leave the first teachings received. Hossein planned to retrieve loss of faith he perceived. Many people did leave the first teachings received. Hossein planned to retrieve loss of faith he perceived. Guide, you would be in place of Rasul to restore the sacred ring.
There's a certain set of rules when it comes to the act of war, setting out what can and cannot be done during an armed conflict. And should that law be breached, then the International Criminal Court, or ICC, is tasked with investigating and bringing guilty parties to justice. Yet it seems the court is losing its credibility, as the ICC has recently announced that it intends to abandon its inquiry into British war crimes during the Iraq War, leaving the victims of British atrocities in the country equally abandoned as they seek justice against the British military. However, in spite of the case being dropped, the prosecutor behind the investigation, Fatou Bensouda, has been left in no doubt that the British military committed no end of crimes while stationed in Iraq, leaving many questioning why the ICC would suddenly drop the case.
But obviously because Britain is one of the permanent five members of the Security Council. And on political grounds, Britain has actually been fairly supportive of the International Criminal Court, even when its close ally and boss, in fact, the US, has fought against it. The British have stood by it, and they've been fairly consistent on it.
So what then are the allegations against the British? Crimes that have said to have been committed include willful killing of innocent civilians, torture of prisoners of war, inhumane and cruel treatment, and rape, all of which are highly illegal under the international rules of conflict and hence constitute as war crimes. The decision by the ICC to drop the case is being blamed on the lack of evidence submitted by the British military, raising the question from Human Rights Watch as to why the UK government has repeatedly shown little interest in investigating the crimes committed by its army. However, the British are no strangers to turning a blind eye to their crimes, as demonstrated through their brutal occupation of states during their imperial days, with the British also having been involved in conflicts in Afghanistan, the north of Ireland, and elsewhere. It remains to be seen as to whether the war crimes seen in Iraq have not been emulated elsewhere, and much like these, left to be forgotten in the past, just like the victims who were subjected to the British crimes. With more and more allegations coming to light of crimes being committed during conflict, from the abuse of Iraqi prisoners by the US and British, to the recent allegations that Australian Special Forces were involved in the killing of innocent civilians in order to pass initiation tests, it just goes to show how deep the problem really lies. Currently, the World War Crimes Court is also heavily involved in the investigation of US crimes committed during conflict in Iraq and Afghanistan. Yet could the investigation into such crimes be suddenly dropped by the ICC should the US military refuse to cooperate? There does, however, lie a problem in the authority of the ICC, namely that the US has stated that it just does not recognise the court, with the US President Donald Trump stating that the ICC has no jurisdiction over them, something that's been echoed by the Israeli regime, who, much like the US, UK and Australia, are guilty of war crimes and crimes against humanity. Yet with the UK failing to assist the ICC in its investigation, nor having even brought one single prosecution against any of its personnel, how then can the ICC execute justice with no parties interested in cooperating with them or even acknowledging its authority?
Well, it isn't really. I think that the British have actually prosecuted the military for various crimes over the years. not enough of them. I mean, they've committed many of them over the centuries, you know, whether it was in India or Kenya or, you know, even more recently. But they have prosecuted some. In Northern Ireland, they were prosecuting people. But in this case, they've investigated and they've... But I'm not trying to make excuses for them, but from their point of view, they could say that they didn't have enough evidence to meet the burden of a prosecution.
Should the ICC continue to be ignored or see its authority blanked, the question that remains to be asked is whether the body has lost all credibility, and if so, how can the rest of the international community allow the US and its allies to undermine such international bodies as and when it suits them?
Large gaps, a looming deadline, and still no appetite for any compromise. The European Union and Britain are digging their heels in, sending jitters throughout Europe. Britain and the European Union face another fast-approaching deadline to conclude marathon talks on their future relationship. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson arrived in Brussels on Wednesday and sat down for tense talks with European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen 3 weeks before the Brexit transition period ends. The two failed to break the logjams in the talks. The only thing the two sides agreed on was perhaps to continue the talks at least through Sunday. The negotiations are tough and stressful because so much is at stake. UK and EU positions remain far apart over access to fishing waters, rules about stabilizing businesses, and how any new deal would be enforced and policed.
Britain controls a tremendous amount of sovereign territory in the sea, and that was basically ceded to Brussels to decide what's done with that back in 1973. So that, I think, is going to be the big sticking point. You know, the traditionally large area of sea around Britain, including out into the Atlantic, which Britain has controlled, has been extremely bountiful, particularly for the French fishermen who've been fishing those seas. And so I think possibly the fishing rights are going to be the biggest sticking point.
The UK Premier admitted after his talks in Brussels that there was, quote, a strong possibility that Britain and the EU would fail to hammer out a free trade agreement at the end of the year. The disappointing outcome of the talks in Brussels triggered the EU to publish contingency plans for the split in trading ties. Observers believe the publication of the EU contingency plans at this point shows that the Europeans are seriously preparing for a possible no-deal Brexit. The European bloc says it intends to avoid immediate chaos at the beginning of January.
The publication of contingency plans by Brussels is actually quite useful, but you know, this is the sort of thing that should have been published, I think, years ago. So it was laid out clearly for the public and for businesses, the sort of thing that may happen if there was no deal.
Long-running negotiations on a trade deal with Britain seem to be reaching a make-or-break moment. But the EU member states insist that despite the looming deadline, they will not be forced into a bad deal. Some European leaders have been loud in rejecting any unsatisfactory agreement. French President Emmanuel Macron has been particularly outspoken. He has insisted that UK firms can expect preferential access to Europe's single market only if they obey its rules. France is worried that the British side is pushing for a deal that could give UK companies an unfair competitive advantage in the European market. The French government has warned that France could veto a bad deal, accusing London of seeking to divide the EU to get better terms. France's demands and concerns are widely shared by other EU member states. European diplomats say all countries in the European Union are serious about defending their collective interests.
The European Union and Brussels do not want to give Britain a deal which any other state in the EU will look at and think that's something we could do with and we would like. So on that level, they want to give Britain a bad deal.
Meanwhile, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has shown little sign of flexibility. Is he bluffing, or does he really believe the UK can easily weather the storm even if it leaves the bloc without a deal? An economically damaging divorce would undoubtedly hurt both sides. But observers warn that the UK would be impacted much more severely than the EU in case of a no-deal departure.
as one of the world's worst-kept secrets, but evidence pointing to the involvement of the Saudi regime into the killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi has been kept hidden from the public domain based on intelligence service requests. However, for the first time since the assassination of the journalist in the Saudi consulate in Turkey, a US judge has ordered the partial disclosure of any evidence held by the US intelligence agencies to be delivered to a New York court within a fortnight. It's most likely that the judge in question, Paul Engelmeyer, is referring to a list of exhibits linked to the murder, and in particular to a tape recording of the incident in which the sound of Khashoggi and the perpetrators of the crime can be heard. Already, the CIA have concluded that the murder was approved by the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, although not actually present at the time of the killing, but was more than likely the one who ordered and oversaw the operation taking place.
What I do have is evidence suggesting that the responsibilities of high-level officials may be engaged and therefore is requiring further investigation, in particular of the Crown Prince, for a variety of reasons. The first one is that the people directly implicated in the murder reported to him. So there is a reporting line here that needs to be further investigated.
With the court taking such a step, it could be the first phase in ousting those truly responsible for the murder, and more importantly, removing the cloak of immunity that Bin Salman, for one, is happy to hide behind, hence finally demanding some notion of accountability.
It's a state killing, and as such, it is important that the state of Saudi Arabia be held accountable. So far, there has been no move on the part of the international community to treat the execution of Mr. Khashoggi as something that was sponsored, incited, ordered by the state.
What now remains to be seen is whether the likes of the CIA and other agencies in the US will obey the court order, or will they too hide behind the veil of national security interests in order to protect the likes of Bin Salman from finally being brought to justice. It seems that the young and inexperienced Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia has allowed the power to go to his head, already forging a negative reputation for himself, as demonstrated in his range of recklessly backed actions since taking the position of Crown Prince. Yet could his actions now be coming back to haunt him? With the order by the US court to expose the tapes surrounding the murder, could the heavily cash-influenced and petrodollar relationship between the US and the Saudi regime be turning sour? Bin Salman's also been accused of sending a murder hit squad to Canada to assassinate former Saudi intelligence official Saad al-Jabri, something that Bin Salman strongly denies. Yet all the evidence points towards the favoured modus operandi of the Crown Prince following the foiling of the plot by the Canadian security services. There's also speculation that Bin Salman met with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in a secret meeting just prior to the assassination of Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. However, the meeting has been denied, yet somehow suggests that Bin Salman was aware and briefed about the Israeli regime plot to murder on Iranian soil. But there's a saving grace for Bin Salman, namely the protection he enjoys from the current US President, Donald Trump. Following the murder of Khashoggi, Trump was happy to turn a blind eye to the event, likely dazed by the wads of cash flowing in from Saudi Arabia to the US through arms deals and more.
We also have a great ally in Saudi Arabia. They give us a lot of jobs, they give us a lot of business, a lot of economic development.
What now remains to be seen is whether the president-elect, Joe Biden, will be as accommodating towards Bin Salman as his predecessor, and if not, will Bin Salman survive without Uncle Donald by his side? March the 15th, 2019, saw one of the world's bloodiest massacres in modern history when Brenton Tarrant, a white supremacist, walked into Christchurch Mosque and opened fire on worshippers, armed with automatic weapons that left many dead and a society deeply scarred. Following an extensive inquiry by the New Zealand authorities, the final report has suggested that there was a series of failures ahead of the incident that, although may not have prevented the attack, has certainly left many lessons to be learned for the future. It left the Prime Minister of New Zealand, Jacinda Ardern, apologising for the failings and claiming that measures will be taken to prevent such acts in the future. One of the main findings, and something that's no doubt valid for countries across the globe, is the institutional racism that occurred prior to the attack, as well as an unconscious bias which is embedded into Western security and police services. Yet in spite of multiple warnings by the Muslim community in New Zealand regarding a rise in hate crime, it appears that nothing was done. So why then were the allegations being made, not taken seriously by those that should have? Yet the sad truth is that it's not just New Zealand that's seeing a rise in hatred against Muslims, as Islamophobia is on the rise across the world, with cases clear in Europe, the US, France, India, and beyond.
Islamophobia, this crime, this hate crime, should be defined very precisely and should be adopted as a law in every country, because it's distorted and they don't know what is Islamophobia, and people are swinging right and left and hitting the Muslims, you know, in media and everywhere, and they're getting away with it. And it's you know, the hatred against Muslims is growing in a lot of places, and the Muslims are becoming, a lot of them, not all of them obviously, are becoming immune to these attacks. It's become a normality because they're trying to adopt these you know, Western governments and Western societies, and they're overlooking some of them, these issues. But these issues, they accumulate and they start to grow problems, and eventually we see the results as the New Zealand Christchurch attack, or the attack in Quebec.
One only has to look at the latest action movies and video games hitting the screens to see that racism is rife across the world, in particular when it comes to anti-Islamic sentiments, with the stereotypical bad guy being cast as a Muslim extremist. Furthermore, anti-Islamic feelings have been demonstrated in France with the publication of offensive cartoons portraying the Prophet Muhammad, which, having been published in magazines, shows another medium in which Islamophobia exists. Yet it's how different leaders are dealing with the issue that truly dictates how a nation will come together to fight religious discrimination, with Jacinda Ardern of New Zealand fully supporting the Muslim community, whilst President Emmanuel Macron in France labelled the act of publishing cartoons as free speech. So with the world so openly exposed to such hatred through a variety of mediums, how then can the problem be addressed?
In regards to this question, it's very clear that for many, many years, the media has been exploiting, the way to criticize Muslims, you know, by labeling them, for instance, as Islamists or terrorists, that they are a threat to, for instance, the Western governments and the social lifestyle here inside the West. And this has become now a normality. You know, people listen to it all the time in media. This Islamists, these Muslims, these people are coming from war-torn countries, and they're trying to impose their Sharia laws, for instance. I mean, this continues on in all the media all the time. And nobody holds them accountable for using such labels on people.
One of the main methods for fighting such acts is to lead from the top. Therefore, the example of how to embrace integration, equality, and anti-racist sentiments should be demonstrated to the public by world leaders. Yet with the likes of Macron, Trump, and many others both publicly and privately glued to their discriminatory views, there has to be a change at the top before the idea finally trickles down to the masses.